I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome back to Radio Time. Stephen Call writes in his new book about ExxonMobil titled Private Empire that the company is essentially a corporate state within the American state. The former CEO, Lee Raymond, told an executive, "I'm not a U.S. company and I don't make decisions based on what's good for the U.S." Call was able to penetrate this secretive organization, conduct hundreds of interviews, read documents, including WikiLeaks, to create a portrait of this enormously powerful and profitable corporation. The book begins with the Exxon Valdez oil spill in 1989 and ends with the BP Deep Horizon explosion and oil spill in 2010. Stephen Call is a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, also president of the New America Foundation, and a staff writer at The New Yorker, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Steve Call, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. It's been a bunch of years.
Thank you, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. I'm interested in this corporate state within the American state. What do you mean by that?
Well, first of all, ExxonMobil is very, very large. It takes some doing just to get your mind around their scale. Last year, $450 billion in revenue. That's more than the annual economic activity of most countries in the world. It's about the size of Norway. Secondly, they're distributed all over the world. They operate in more than 150 countries. And they see themselves as sovereign. Their loyalty is to their shareholders and to the laws that require them to act in the interests of shareholders first, second, and third. And they've become untethered from the national system, the American system, where they happen to be headquartered. As that quote you read suggests, they feel very self-conscious of their own independence around the world in that sense.
Well, so when the former CEO Raymond said, you know, essentially, he says, I'm not a U.S. company, talking about his own company, he means that.
He really does. And, you know, here's a guy who's a very close personal friend of Dick Cheney, sees himself as an American patriot, lives in Texas, you know, very much associated culturally and politically with the United States. But in operating this independent entity, did not want to be bound by the policies of any government in Washington, even the Bush administration, with which he was obviously friendly. And often I was surprised by the extent to which ExxonMobil went its own way, even when the Bush administration wanted it to do something.
Their headquarters in Texas, referred to as the Death Star. What does that mean?
By their employees.
Well, by their own employees, exactly.
It's a sort of antiseptic corporate headquarters near the Dallas-Fort Worth airport, and it has a kind of ominous quality about it. It's very, very quiet. It's a very formal, conservative culture. People work there for life. It has the air of a military influence. There's a very rule-bound system of conformity and lifelong employment. And inside the headquarters, one of the executives who worked there from time to time said it felt like a neutron bomb had gone off. You know, there were no people, just furniture and quietude, and you hear this kind of click, click, click of heels across the marble floor, and the guards at the desk refer to everyone formally as Mr. or Ms., and it's an unusual bastion of old corporate culture in America, very conservative.
And very secretive.
Very secretive as well, as part of its business model and also its culture. Their own public relations people say that their policy is just to say no comment in 50 different languages. But it's you know, it's more than that. They really want to keep their heads down. They don't want to call attention to themselves. They have outsized influence in all sorts of settings, in Washington, D.C., in West Africa, in capitals around the world. They have a relentlessly determined public policy, lobbying, and communications strategy, but they don't want to call attention to themselves, in part because they do business in a lot of nasty places. And the host governments are not the world's most attractive, particularly in places like Equatorial Guinea and Chad. So by keeping a low profile, they're able to build a kind of durable stability for their own operations.
I want to get to some of those nasty places, but I'm curious about how you were able, you got a lot of interviews, how you were able to not just penetrate this organization, but get people to talk to you if they are so reticent and want to be, in a sense, under the radar.
Well, it was mostly an outside-in project. I mean, I got, as the book's notes describe, I think I had like 8 ExxonMobil current executives provide authorized background interviews. None of them agreed to be quoted by name, but 8 out of 400 people that I interviewed, I think. So it was mostly working from lawsuits, from Freedom of Information Act requests that I made to the State Department for cables about their operations in different countries, talking to former managers and executives. And it was hard because they're so disciplined. They're more disciplined than the Central Intelligence Agency as a target of journalism. The rate of refusal when I would ask people to talk to me was higher than any other institution that I've attempted to report on this way. But there are ways in. You chip, chip, chip. You get people to help. They lead you to the next person and so forth.
Well, you have also said harder to penetrate than getting inside the bin Ladens, who you have written about.
Yes. And, you know, they tie people up with nondisclosure agreements and basically put their pensions at risk and their retirement at risk. And since it's a place of lifetime employment, it really makes it material for people when they decide whether to cooperate with a project like this. But I think the bigger picture is, you know, here's this, and I came to think about this really only as I was three quarters of the way through the reporting. Here's this enormous institution in American life, as we say, $450 billion a year in revenue, and all kinds of political strategies that matter to our energy economy, to the way our chemicals are regulated in our society and so forth. And they receive virtually no scrutiny. I mean, the whole 4 years I was working on this project, there was nobody in my side view mirrors as a journalist. And I'm used to working, when I work on national security issues or even the bin Laden family, there's usually three or four people out there in my side view mirrors working on the same subjects in one way or another. And I reflected on that thinking, well, let's make a list of 30 other influential corporations in this country. How much journalistic scrutiny do any of them receive? And if they're well-resourced and they have this closed strategy, it's very easy, I think, for them to win at that strategy.
Well, I was thinking about Apple as I was reading your book. Now, they have gotten some scrutiny because of Foxconn and some of their factories in other parts of the world. Very secretive, eccentric Steve Jobs, his vision for this particular company, different from ExxonMobil, but it's interesting to see some of those parallels.
Yeah, and I read the Jobs biography and found it fascinating. As you say, on the one hand, they are both very closed companies and both very top-down, very much had been, at least in the Jobs era at Apple, driven by a kind of command management system. And you know, in many ways, focused on a kind of relentless attention to detail that distinguished them from their competitors. Their differences are interesting to reflect on. Apple requires creative innovation, at least in design and in conception, that an oil utility company, which you could almost say ExxonMobil is, doesn't require in the same way. But that's changing, I think, for ExxonMobil. For them to succeed in the world that they're in now, we can talk about the reasons later, for them to succeed, they need great science and great engineering, world-beating. And I'm not sure it's easy to recruit the best scientists in the country who are increasingly women, for example, and who are in a global setting increasingly diverse, if they're working at a corporation that is so unpopular, so rule-bound, so unrelenting in its sense of imperative about oil and gas, that when these scientists go home to their families at Thanksgiving or the equivalent around the world and tell their relatives where they work, everyone sort of sucks in their breath in disapproval. That doesn't happen at Apple. That's one difference.
Well, that's interesting. Let me ask you a bit about Lee Raymond. He's the former CEO, but nonetheless a character. Mm. Came on after the Exxon Valdez oil spill, known as Iron Ass. Mm. I mean, and I guess other names as well.
Yes. Yeah, he was a larger-than-life figure in the industry, seen as the most effective chief executive of his era, awfully tough guy. Within the ExxonMobil sort of Marine Corps culture, he was the toughest of the tough and ruled with a very direct, blunt manner, intimidating. Many of his senior colleagues found him even abusive, at least in an oral sense, and he was tough and demanding. He felt that he had inherited a slow bureaucracy that he wanted to reform, and that only relentless, drill sergeant tones would get him where he wanted to go. But he also was, like a lot of ExxonMobil executives, deeply loyal and embedded in the place, sentimental about it, would weep when people retired and felt as if he was presiding over a real community that was his entire life, and saw himself as the sovereign also of an empire. My favorite example of this concretely was when he was meeting with Vladimir Putin in 2003 at the New York Stock Exchange, and he was about to buy controlling interest in what was then Russia's largest private oil company. And he basically says to Putin, look, I'm not going to do this unless you tell me you're comfortable with my owning 51% of this corporation. And Putin says, well, if you do that, does that mean that whenever I want to do something with this oil company, I have to come and talk to you about it? And Raymond says, yeah, but that's not so bad. It's like that in a lot of places in the world. This is to Vladimir Putin. So I think he did see himself as more or less the peer of heads of state around the world.
Well, and your book begins with this Exxon Valdez oil spill of 1989. I have to say, I sadly, frankly, hadn't thought about it in the kind of detail that you write about it, and oftentimes blamed on a drunk captain.
Right.
But you describe that it was preventable. And it was a systemic failure on the part of Exxon at that time.
It's important because those structural problems that actually are responsible for that wreck are still with us, and the dilemmas of risk management are still with us. And because the captain of the ship did have a documented drinking problem, and it may have influenced an important decision he made to leave the bridge as they left the harbor, but nonetheless, National Transportation Safety Board and other investigators concluded that both corporate irresponsibility and weak regulation were truly responsible for the wreck. Corporate irresponsibility because in the 10 years before the accident, ExxonMobil had cut its workforce from 180,000 to 100,000 by 80,000 jobs in 10 years and were never really called out as to whether that was undermining their safety culture, which it obviously was. Mm-hmm. And the Coast Guard didn't have the capacity to watch this ship as it lost its way, didn't even have radar in place because of the 80s deregulation drive. Now, the bigger picture that's still with us that was present in the Deepwater Horizon spill in 2010, and I think is going to be a part of our world for the next 10 or 15 years, is that these companies are being driven by business competition into riskier and riskier environments. In order to win against Chinese oil competitors or Russian oil competitors, ExxonMobil has to demonstrate that it can do technologically what no one has done before, drill in deeper and deeper water, drill underneath the Arctic ice, drill in harsh weather climates. Fracking is another example. These are frontiers of technology and environmental management. And the corporations say, we've got it under control. We've got our risk managements. We've learned our lessons. But the regulators are not strong enough to really scrutinize that claim.
Well, and it reminds me of this whole debate about the banking system in the U.S. and whether things are not just too big to fail, but even too big to manage, and whether regulators actually know what's going on inside of these big corporations.
I think there's something to that. And it's a little bit like aviation over the 20th century. In order to get to the point where when an American passenger at least boards a commercial airliner, you have a pretty good confidence that there's an automated system of regulation and self-policing that keeps these planes as safe as planes can be. But it took decades to learn all of what needed to be learned to manage risk in commercial flight. And in these areas of fracking and deep water drilling and Arctic drilling and harsh climate drilling, we're in the equivalent of the early 1930s in aviation history. I mean, we're still learning from accidents, basically. And also, as you point out, the capacity of government regulators, scientifically, technologically, and otherwise, is just so far behind where the corporations are. It's very difficult for them to reach good judgments.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Steve Call about his new book. It's called Private Empire, ExxonMobil and American Power. He's won the Pulitzer Prize 2 times, and he's president of the New America Foundation. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
ChristianaCare Health System's Center for Heart and Vascular Health supports WHYY. Studies show experience makes a difference in patient outcomes. Recognized by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, ChristianaCare cardiovascular surgeons perform more than 800 open heart procedures each year, and the team of heart specialists treats more than 8,000 total heart and vascular patients annually. ChristianaCare, with locations in Pennsylvania and Delaware. More online at christianacare.org/heartleaders.
Bring your appetite, food fanatics, as WHYY celebrates some of the region's greatest culinary minds with Best of the Chefs, a 2-hour tasting featuring an array of area restaurants, breweries, and businesses. They'll serve up their tastiest treats, and your votes decide who is crowned Best of the Chefs in several mouth-watering categories. Also, a raffle, beer garden, and live music. Thursday, June 21st. Tickets at whyy.org/member experience.
From the shores of the Dead Sea comes one of the most significant archaeological finds of the 20th century, the Dead Sea Scrolls at the Franklin Institute. Featuring more than 600 Holy Land artifacts and a rare glimpse of the authentic Dead Sea Scrolls. Also a look at millennia-old traditions that continue to impact Western society today. The Dead Sea Scrolls, now open at the Franklin Institute. For tickets, 215-448-1200 or online at fi.edu. The Franklin Institute supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Steve Call about ExxonMobil, one of the most profitable, powerful, influential, and secretive companies in the world. And his book is called Private Empire, ExxonMobil, and American Power. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You had mentioned President George W. Bush earlier, and he's quoted as saying, no one tells those guys what to do. He was referring to ExxonMobil.
Yeah, he was in a meeting with the Indian prime minister who wanted him to lobby ExxonMobil about the allocation of ownership in a Russian oil deal, and that's what he said. Nobody tells those guys what to do, which I think shocked the Indian prime minister, because in India, you do tell state oil companies what to do.
But you don't tell ExxonMobil what to do.
You don't tell ExxonMobil what to do.
What was Vice President Dick Cheney's relationship with ExxonMobil?
He was a very close friend of Lee Raymond, the chief executive that we were talking about earlier. They had been neighbors in Dallas when Cheney ran Halliburton and Oil Services Corporation. Their wives were friends. They were social friends. They went hunting together. So when Cheney became vice president, Raymond had direct access through this intimate friendship to the vice president. And it took me a while to understand that all the noise that surrounded Cheney's energy tax force and whether Exxon had access to it was kind of irrelevant, because Raymond basically, when he wanted something, he just went to Washington and met privately with Cheney at his residence, and they talked about what was happening in Saudi Arabia or in Russia. And when he needed intervention in an oil negotiation, he would selectively, when he thought Cheney could really make a difference, he'd ask him to make a call for him to the Emir of the United Arab Emirates. And that happened in one case that the book documents, where they won a competition from Shell on the basis of that intervention.
So he was able to tell the vice president what to do?
Well, I think Cheney also is probably not someone that you tell what to do very easily, but they had the best way to think of it, here's two old friends with a very common global outlook about climate change, about power politics. They departed company on the Iraq War, which Raymond opposed and Cheney obviously believed in. But otherwise, they basically saw the world in similar tones, and so it was a very easy conversation for them.
How would you describe the relationship today between ExxonMobil and the Obama White House?
I think it's much more distant. President Obama campaigned against ExxonMobil by name in the 2008 campaign and also pledged to end the age of oil, came in with determination to pass a cap-and-trade bill to attack global warming, created subsidies and investments in alternative energy. And for a long while, I think ExxonMobil struggled to even have any strategy to talk to any part of the Democratic Party. To the extent they had one, they were much closer to the Hillary Clinton campaign in the primary, because they had enjoyed good relations with the Clinton administration in the 1990s. The ExxonMobil lobbyists I was able to interview said they felt they had just as easy access to the Clinton administration as to the Bush administration. But the Obama administration was a point of departure for them.
And just how powerful, and I guess how many are there of ExxonMobil's lobbyists? You know, were you able to count heads or count noses?
Yeah, and I did. I had built all these grids, and my study was full of charts and disclosure documents, but they spent $161 million on disclosed federal lobbying in the 10 years after the merger. They run their lobbying the way they run everything else, very much a command culture. All career employees. They don't hire a lot of hired guns. They're not interested in going on TV or they want to keep a low profile, focused on their business interests, and they are very well resourced, very relentless. And their basic strategy in Washington is to invest in the Republican Party. The top 10 recipients of ExxonMobil's Political Action Committee spending in the 10 years after the merger were all House Republicans. They work on a filibuster-proof alliance in the Senate and friendly House Republicans. They are more direct. They direct more, a higher percentage of their spending to the Republican Party than virtually any other large corporation in the United States that's politically active, that's owned by shareholders. And I was really struck by that. I thought Walmart, Dow Chemical, a lot of other corporations would be aligned with the Republican Party for ideological reasons. But in fact, most of them split their money about 50-50 on a kind of theory of equal access. But ExxonMobil is, they're very relentless in their focus, and their focus is on Republican candidates.
So if corporations are people, according to Citizens United, this is a powerful person.
Yeah, this is a powerful person and also a very focused person. Mm-hmm. A lot of the what makes them different from the kind of cranky billionaire super PAC world that we live in now is that they are focused on the long run. They are focused on a global strategy. They want to outlast governments in Washington. They want to block bad things from happening to them. They're not focused on the short-term election cycle. They're focused on 30, 40-year strategy.
And they have outlasted all these administrations and, I guess, some members of Congress.
They really have. And they've prevented things from happening that seemed likely at certain moments. Climate change legislation being a good example. Kyoto Accords were signed in 1997. That particular bargain was opposed by a lot of members of Congress for a lot of different reasons, but ExxonMobil did something fairly radical for corporations at that time, which was that they invested in groups that attacked the science itself. And they ended up, I think, being pretty effective at that. They polluted public understanding of global warming science to an extent where today the gap between what say 97% of mainstream climate scientists believe is happening and why it's happening and what the public believes is very wide, wider than in any other area where science intersects with public policy.
And you think ExxonMobil has something to do with that?
I think the investments they made, some of them surreptitious, very well resourced. They weren't completely alone, but they were the largest shareholder-owned corporation to engage in such radical activity, and they really pursued it, ended it in 2005, but did it for, you know, 8-10 years, and I think made a real impact.
You include some titles of some of the books that were written, I guess supported by this ExxonMobil. Red Hot Lies, How Global Warming Alarmists Use Threats, Fraud, and Deception to Keep You Misinformed. The Global Warming Deception, How a Secret Elite Plans to Bankrupt America and Steal Your Freedom. As just a taste of some of their...
Yeah, that was those were a couple of titles out of that movement. And it was a free market ideology group that rented itself out, groups that rented themselves out to ExxonMobil and oil corporations. I think they probably had these convictions, but they notably were not climate scientists. Very few of them were scientists at all. Many of them were economic or sort of communications mm-hmm. specialists. And they constructed a campaign that seemed influenced by the tobacco industry's campaign to cast doubts on the dangers of smoking in the 1960s and 70s.
Using think tanks and so-called experts.
Think tanks and experts and outsourced experts and a sort of focus on doubt because, you know, science is, by its nature, riddled with doubt and debate. That's how science advances. And that creates for a cynical campaigner an opportunity to enter and try to spread doubt even where the doubt doesn't exist.
You write here, Exxon was America's energy policy. This is looking back over the last couple of decades. But in order to understand this country's energy policy, you need to understand Exxon.
Yeah, and they're oil and gas purists is the first plank of their energy policy. But by that, I meant two things. One, their scale at $450 billion in revenue, compare that to the budget of the Department of Energy or the amount of money that presidents put behind their periodic pledges to end America's dependency on imported oil. Never comes to pass for a reason. The scale of ExxonMobil's resources far outstrips the scale of the federal government's efforts to create a durable energy policy first. Second, I came to understand as I was working on this, you know, every industrial democracy in the world, every free society has a giant state oil company because oil is so central to our energy economy. And, you know, Total in France and BP in Britain and Eni in Italy. Well, ExxonMobil is ours, except that they live in opposition to the state. Mm-hmm. In Europe, these state oil companies are aligned with the government. They work together for good or ill. Here, the current chief executive, Rex Tillerson, recently told a magazine that his favorite book is Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, which is this touchstone of dystopian libertarian suspicion of governmental power. So only in America would the leader of our state-owned oil company with such enormous revenue live in suspicious hostility to the state that gave birth to his corporation, while sitting, by the way, on the source of the greatest private concentrated power in the United States.
You can do that if you're wealthy and influential and global.
And live in Texas and really are not much scrutinized or held accountable by your shareholders. Because I think one point that's worth making, who owns ExxonMobil? We all do. I mean, they have more than 1 million individual shareholders and government workers, teachers' unions, all own ExxonMobil. Part of the problem is we have not as a nation, had a conversation about corporate responsibility beyond profit-making. And those owners are in a position to push ExxonMobil on some of these issues.
And that's Steve Call, our guest today on Radio Times. He's won the Pulitzer Prize two times, and he's got a new book, which we are talking about, called Private Empire, ExxonMobil and American Power. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You write about several countries, poor countries run by largely by dictators, several of them in Africa. I'd like to talk about Chad, and ExxonMobil certainly has a presence in Chad. Why is that an important country for us to understand?
Well, it started, I made a map of where they owned oil and gas in the world, and was surprised to see that 25% of their oil production was coming out of West Africa. So I traveled there early on in the project, and I was in Chad, which is a benighted country. Only 11 million people live there, but 181st out of 188 countries on the Human Development Index, life expectancy of less than 50 years. A very poor country, really sort of fourth world. And as I was traveling and reporting on ExxonMobil's activities there, the first question that came to my mind is, why are they here? Why would they bother with landlocked, poor, troubled, violent Chad? And the answer is important and interesting. They used to have easy access to Middle Eastern oil. They used to own a piece of Saudi Arabia's oil, Iran's oil, Iraq's oil. But resource nationalism in the 1970s locked them out of all of these countries as they took back possession of their own oil and basically said, this is a right of sovereignty, a right of citizenship. No foreign corporation shall own our oil. So they lost access to the easy oil in the world. And they've been driven relentlessly to weak and unstable countries where the nationalism may still be there, but the countries are still too weak to actually exercise their prerogative of ownership of oil. They need ExxonMobil to get it out of the ground. They can't do it themselves. So the reason they're in Chad is the reason also that they're in Nigeria and Angola and Equatorial Guinea and lots of other weak states. And the other consequence of their being there is that their outsized influence is even more exacerbated when the country is so weak. They loom so much larger in the place.
Well, just to underscore what you said, you write that the U.S. sends a couple of million dollars to Chad, whereas Exxon gives them a half a billion dollars in taxes and royalties.
In a typical year, yeah. And this also involved a very sort of experimental program that Exxon endorsed that was carried out by the World Bank to try to help Chad overcome the pattern that poor countries have of having oil-led development lead only to corruption and not to improvements in the living standards of the great number of citizens. And so the World Bank constructed this special bargain where Chad agreed to sequester its oil revenue and spend it only on health, education, social improvement. And at a certain point, the authoritarian leader, dictator Idris Deby, decided he wanted out of that bargain because he wanted to buy weapons to fight off guerrillas. And at the moment he made this decision to defy the World Bank, to defy the Bush administration, ExxonMobil was writing him checks for north of $700 million a year. So he just bought out the World Bank's loans and said to Exxon, okay, it's just you and me now. And ExxonMobil, of course, its business interests are, we just want stability. Of course, in a perfect world, we'd like every government to be an excellent government, but we have to take the world as we find it sort of attitude.
And the idea is that they're good at finding oil, and I guess getting oil to customers and keeping their shareholders happy.
Exactly. And you know, they'll say, well, we create some jobs and we do benefit the employees who come to work for us, but it's a small segment of the Chadian population.
Well, let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. We have, looks like Diane from Easton joining us on Radio Times. And Diane, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Everything I'm hearing, I find very alarming. I had read another author, John Perkins, who promotes the idea that there's a corporatocracy that's actually ruling the world at this point. It sounds as though ExxonMobil is a large part of this corporatocracy, if it does indeed exist. And if this is what is happening, is the world not now being ruled by people whose only drive is profit? There's little concern for individuals who aren't shareholders.
Well, Diane, let me give Steve Call a chance to respond. Thanks for the call.
We live in an age of corporate power. There's no question about it. And it's greater, that corporate power is greater than it was 20 years ago. It's greater in the United States than at any time since the Gilded Age, the age of Teddy Roosevelt. And this is statistically available. The percentage of corporate income in comparison to household income or small business income has not been higher since, I think, like 1900. So what we feel intuitively about the rise of corporations and their influence over public life is, I think, true.
Mm, Diane, thanks for the call to Radio Times to see what Rick from Hokesson has to say. And Rick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, Marty, thanks for your insightful show, as always. I wish to take exception that Exxon works, and our family is an Exxon shareholder and proud of it for decades, and we'll keep it. And proud of what it does. But there are many, many countries who would give their right arm to have Exxon as theirs. But to say that Exxon works in counter with our government implies, in my mind, that you would like Exxon to be controlled by the government. And much like, say, Venezuela or Mexico or Argentina, just recently, Madam Kirchner, the president of the country, has renationalized the stock. And you may also be aware that in each of those countries, those national oil companies have not reinvested in the system, and thereby the domestic production of each of those countries has fallen greatly.
Well, Rick, I appreciate the call. I'm looking at the clock, and I want to make sure that Steve Call has a chance to respond to your question. It's a good one.
Yeah, no, I think it's a fair comment. I'm trying to describe the way things are. I'm certainly not advocating the nationalization of ExxonMobil, and I also think it would produce bad results for American consumers and households. But I am questioning whether in this country we have an adequate conversation about what corporate responsibility means, given that we are allowing under our free market system of laws to have corporations rise to the role that they're playing in our communities and in our capital and in our political system and in the lives of other nations around the world where American welfare is at issue through national security and other and economic reasons. You know, do we have a conversation about who these corporations are, what we want from them besides profit-making, if anything? You know, I think a lot of other democracies around the world have this conversation. It leads to decisions like the one we just saw in Argentina. Sometimes they decide we want to nationalize. But we're in a position where we're not even aware of these sort of mini-states within our political system, how they conceive of their own activity, their own sovereignty, their own influence. And I just think as a journalist, I came away from this project wishing to learn more about how these corporations operate and hoping that that kind of information will lead citizens to ask, what do we want from them?
Well, and is there an answer to that?
Well, I think there are forms of social responsibility and economic responsibility that are not going to undermine profit-making that perhaps are different from what our expectations imposed on these corporations sound like now. I mean, for example, we do not have a conversation about what shareholders can expect from corporate governance by way of commitment to development in the poor societies where they work and where they have such outsized influence. In Europe, that conversation is front and center. Companies like Shell and BP have already been changed by what shareholders demand of them.
Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation and our callers. Just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. Talking with Steve Call today on Radio Times. He's president of the New America Foundation and the author of a new book called Private Empire, ExxonMobil and American Power. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
WHYY is proudly supported by the new University Medical Center of Princeton at Plainsboro. This new hospital is now open. It was designed with all single-patient rooms and innovations that may help improve healing and lower infections. Features include a rapid response emergency room and physicians from the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia to care for children. The new University Medical Center of Princeton at Plainsboro, redefining care. Now open. More at princetonhcs.org.
It ain't necessarily so. On the next Fresh Air, David Alan Grier. He's nominated for a Tony for his performance as Sportin' Life in Porgy and Bess. Grier first became known for his work on the sketch comedy show In Living Color. Join us.
Won't you tell us more?
Now, little David,
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Small but oh my.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Will the first democratically elected president of Egypt be secular or Islamist? And what does it matter? We'll preview this week's vote with Thanasi Kambanis. Also, a Republican congressman calls for closing the taxpayer spigot that pays for former presidents' expenses. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Steve Call, president of the New America Foundation, a staff writer at The New Yorker, and he's written several books, including The Taking of Getty Oil, Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan and Bin Laden, and also a book called The Bin Ladens, An Arabian Family in the American Century. His new book is called Private Empire, ExxonMobil, and American Power. I do want to get back to our callers, but let me ask you about fracking, something else that you write about in this book, and ExxonMobil, like other energy companies, many of them getting into the fracking business. But you say that this is could be a different experience for ExxonMobil, and that it would force them to come to these town meetings where residents, not all of them, but some of them, are opposed to fracking. This is not Chad. This is not offshore drilling. These are real people living in real communities concerned about fracking.
Yeah, it's a different kind of political risk here in the United States. And they have made a big bet on unconventional natural gas and the fracking techniques that produce it. They bought the a leading producer in 2010. They're now the leading producer across the country. And I think they probably underestimated the amount of questioning and resistance and environmental campaigning around fracking that they were going to face. The big reason that they're investing in natural gas, in part, is to get away from environments like Chad and to come to the United States, where property rights are sacrosanct and the rule of law is better established. And yet, the political risk in a place like these town halls is it has to do with the suppleness of their communication strategy, the trust factor, whether they can build durable relationships with politicians in both political parties, with community activists, with environmental campaigners. That has not been their strong point, and I think they're going to face a significant amount of political challenge over fracking, as we've already seen in Pennsylvania and along the Marcellus.
You had mentioned cap and trade, but according to what I read in your book, the new CEO favors a carbon tax. I don't know if that makes him unusual as an energy CEO.
Well, it's certainly a big change for ExxonMobil. We were talking before about the era where they funded some of this communications campaigning against climate science. In 2005, they stopped funding the most controversial groups. For a while, I think trying to avoid lawsuits, they took a middle ground position, said, we were never wrong, we were only misunderstood, but we're not doing that anymore. And then in 2009, they really did come forward and endorse a carbon tax. And for the first time, the chief executive of ExxonMobil said the risks of global warming were significant enough to warrant a price on fossil fuels in order to incent change over time.
Was that a legitimate turnaround or part of a strategy, a PR strategy?
I think probably both. I think they certainly were aware of the political effect and the PR effect of making that decision. But I think it was legitimate because I don't think they were persuaded of climate science all of a sudden, at least certainly not the chief executive hasn't indicated that. But I think they were persuaded that they had lost this argument and that a price on carbon was coming, and they wanted to try to influence the way it came, and they preferred a straight-up tax to the more complicated cap-and-trade system.
Let me get looks like Brian from Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Brian, go ahead.
You're
on Radio Times.
I was wondering if you give thought to the sort of life cycle of the ideas that your investigative journalism unearths. You do all this work, and you've got the ability to do it. You write a book. Then who does the follow-up? Do you give thought to that about the public conversation that you mentioned or other implications for the ideas that you unearth?
The idea, Brian, is that what is the next step after this, you mean?
Right. For an investigative journalist who brings all this valuable information,
yeah,
does he give a thought about I do the next steps.
Yeah, I do a little bit. I mean, I'm sort of self-aware that I write big, complicated books that are not exactly, you know, screaming off the airport shelves. I hope they're readable. I try to make them as readable as I possibly can. But the afterlife has to be, for me, on university campuses. I love going out and talking about these books on campuses. I am thrilled when professors find them useful to assign in class and become the basis for discourse for the next generation. Because if you're going to have an impact, having put 4 years of, you know, sweat into something like this, whatever its limitations and its value, you want it to have a readership over more than just the life of a book tour. And to me, that's mostly about students and universities. So I try to construct these books so that they're rigorous and scholarly and transparent enough so that a solid academic teacher could credibly assign them to students.
More important than testifying before Congress?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've testified before Congress, and at times you feel like you're being listened to, but, you know, mostly that's theater. It's already pre-cooked, and it doesn't seem like it has much of an afterlife.
Brian, thanks for the call. Let's see what James from Valley Forge has to say. James, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. I've boycotted Exxon since not long after the Valdez incidents, and noticed that there is a resurgence of the boycott effort now that gas has spiked close to $4 a gallon. Looking this up, I found in 2005 there was a boycott gathered with a lot of major environmental organizations. It didn't seem to last, and I'm calling to see if Steve Call has any insights into the 2005 drive and also the Occupy movement. I think is a great place to take the boycott effort.
James, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, Greenpeace, I think, fiddled with a boycott at one point when they were campaigning against ExxonMobil over this climate science funding. And Greenpeace was, in fact, very effective in bringing ExxonMobil to change its position, I think, by embarrassing the corporation before the public and before its shareholders. Other institutions were involved as well, Union of Concerned Scientists, the Rockefeller family. But I think Greenpeace backed away from the boycott because they felt like they were getting more traction in this sort of exposure campaign, and that they didn't think they could actually deliver much concrete result from a boycott. I think in England, they did mount a more effective campaign of that type, again, all over this global warming issue.
But do you think ExxonMobil is a better company than it was 20 years ago?
Yeah, they reformed themselves after the Valdez. I mean, I think their worker safety record improved dramatically as a result of the reforms that they took. They were shocked into recognition that they had been sloppy and that they had let things drift. And certainly today, their worker safety record is such that if you had a relative who worked at a refinery someplace, you'd prefer them to go to work every day at a place where they're going to come home with, you know, life and limb.
And what about their environmental record?
It's better, but it's not as good as they claim. They sort of give the impression that they've so reformed that they've taken all human fallibility out of their industrial operations. And then every now and then a pipeline bursts in the Yellowstone River or in the Niger Delta where nobody's looking. And you know, the truth is these industrial systems are so large, so complicated, and you cannot take human fallibility out of the equation. The Japanese believed their nuclear industry was foolproof, and one tsunami wave has brought it to an end in a short time. So, and as we were talking about before, it's not just that they're trying to manage risk in a stable environment. Their business model is driving them into riskier and riskier endeavors while they try to manage risk.
Thanks for the call. Let's see what looks like Susan from Bryn Mawr has to say. And Susan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I just want to point out that if you happen to be a stockholder of ExxonMobil, which you might not want to be, but if you are one, the most socially responsible thing you can do is to read your proxy statements and vote them in ways that your conscience determines. In other words, if you find that ExxonMobil is doing environmental damage, often there will be shareholder proposals demanding that Exxon look at this problem, and as a shareholder, it's very important to to read your proxy statements, as hard as they are to read, and to absolutely vote your conscience to the best you have, the best ability you have. I think it's even more, almost more important than voting in national elections, though that, too, is important.
Well, I appreciate the call, Susan. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, it's well said. And it's interesting to compare it to voting in national elections, because we do have this national kind of civics imperative. Everyone should vote, and everyone agrees that everyone should vote. But we don't have that same conversation about corporate responsibility.
Yeah, but she also mentioned how difficult it is to read these.
Yes, well, and of course, yeah, because we value voting in governmental elections, we have a big national conversation about how to make it easier, how to register, how to get you to the polls. But we don't have that conversation about proxy voting among shareholders.
Let's see what Ed from looks like Lansdale has to say. Ed, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
For sake of brevity, any acquaintance with the idea Gull Island Reserve in Utah, believe in Great Salt Lake, owned by Exxon?
Well, I have a quizzical look on our guest face.
Not something I scrutinized.
Okay. No, something I heard on WLWAM 3, America's Trucking Network, 3 in the morning.
Yeah, sorry. We're going to have to say thank you for calling, but yeah, we unfortunately can't take your question. Let me, though, ask you about the Keystone Pipeline and tar sands. Canada, as you write, and others have said, the largest supplier of imported oil to the United States. That might be a surprise to some people.
Yeah, and ExxonMobil is very heavily invested in the tar sands, or the oil sands, as the oil corporations prefer to call them. In fact, if you go on the web, if anybody's listening interested in this, I saw something yesterday that really startled me. There's a magazine called Business Insider that rented a plane and flew up over the tar sands and took photographs, because they were denied access. They don't allow a lot of journalists up there. And the photographs are stunning, of the strip mining and the manufacturing and the refining operations, and the deforestation that goes on in some of these operations. But anyway, Business Insider, enormous photographic collection. But the Keystone controversy arises from the fact that this oil is being produced by Canada. It's going to go somewhere. Should it come by pipeline across the continental United States to refineries in Louisiana and perhaps to global markets from there? Or if we block it from coming to the United States, what do we gain? Is by blocking the pipeline, will the oil sands be any less produced? And I think the uncomfortable truth is no, they won't. They will be produced. Mm-hmm. They'll just be piped across Western Canada and then shipped to Asia. So if the concern is global warming, which is a concern that we're not focused enough on, in my judgment, looking at the science and just listening to scientific testimony over the course of this research, the way to attack it is not to block one pipeline. It's to put a price on carbon-based fuels, or to create other durable policy incentives for change. And so I understand the focus on the pipeline, because it's an issue where campaigners can win, and they can call attention to the problem, they can call attention to warming. So I think those are legitimate reasons to campaign against the pipeline. But you also, I think, have to bear in mind the facts that even if the United States doesn't build this pipeline, it's not going to affect the rate of production of these oil sands.
It'll be interesting to see how President Obama, how he weighs.
Yeah, I think he'll approve it once the election is over, if he's reelected. And we already know that Romney will approve it. So.
Right. Let me ask you about China. China and its oil industry. What do we need to know, or has ExxonMobil, as it?
They study China quite a lot. Yeah, I mean, the main thing is that the growth of their middle class and the demand of middle classes around the world, once they have enough income for cars, assures the future of the oil industry, so far as ExxonMobil is concerned. They do a lot of very rigorous forecasting over the 30 or 40 years ahead, and the biggest factor in their belief that oil has a future is Chinese demand. And the development of middle classes in other developing countries has demonstrated that there seems to be a universal Ken for having two cars in the garage when you get a certain level of household income, no matter what culture you're living in, no matter how crowded the roads are. And China's rate of car ownership now is so far away from what it would naturally be if the economy rises as projected over the next 20 or 30 years, that it means they're going to be driving quite a lot of cars. Now, the question is, will they be pouring gasoline into the tank? And one of the questions that I studied was how ExxonMobil looks at alternative energy technologies. And they study them very carefully, because they don't want to be surprised. I think the only technology that really worries them is battery storage capacity.
Oh.
If there were a huge breakthrough in batteries that would allow cheap all-electric vehicles and the infrastructure to support them on a global scale, then China's rise to two cars in the garage might not benefit oil quite as much.
Have you gotten a response from ExxonMobil, such as it is, to your book?
I haven't had one directly, and I haven't sought one directly. I've been interviewed by journalists who have talked to them, and I've heard different versions of how they've reacted. So, anyway, I don't trust hearsay, and I haven't heard from them directly.
So no comment, right?
No comment, yes.
And what was the most interesting part of – and you clearly did a lot of research to put this book together.
Yeah. I mean, for me personally, traveling in these weak states where nobody goes to look at what's going on in West Africa, I went to Equatorial Guinea, I went to Chad, I went down to the Niger Delta, I went to Aceh where ExxonMobil's gas production took place in the middle of a difficult civil war earlier in this decade. And so on the ground out there and seeing the scale and the political nature of the modern global oil industry, I think was the most interesting work.
And we're almost out of time here, but when one hears about these poor countries with oil, it seems like oil, it becomes this, not burden, but it doesn't help the country. It might help a handful of people or a dictator, but it doesn't help the people.
Academic economists have come up with a label for what you just said, which is they call it the resource curse. And it describes a historical pattern across many different societies in many different places that when a poor country tries to develop through oil or other extractive industries without industrializing, without building a broader economy, the result is not more prosperity for the greater number. It's corruption usually. And sometimes the total economy of the country actually shrinks paradoxically, even though this enormous wealth is being created for the elite, because it distorts the economy and doesn't create incentives for agriculture or industry.
You don't get a broad-based economy.
It's
based on one thing.
There's a sort of why bother, especially if you're in the presidential palace or in the president's family.
Well, Steve Call, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marty, for having me. Great conversation.
You're very welcome. Thank you for joining us today on Radio Time. Steve Call, our guest, that's C-O-L-L. And he won the Pulitzer Prize 2 times for 2 other books that he has written. And the new one is called Private Empire, ExxonMobil, and American Power. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter, email, the archives. It's all there. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show was produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder, along with Jonathan Best. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.